there. You are listening to the Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming at KMUZ.org. This is where Marion and Polk Soil and Water Conservation Districts shine a light on partnerships and programs that conserve our beautiful natural resources in the Willamette Valley. We're illuminating our collective mission of conserving soil, water, and natural resources for urban and agricultural audiences in the Willamette Valley.
I'm your host, Morgan Neal, Outreach Coordinator with the Polk Soil and Water Conservation District. Today, I'm talking with folks from the Lucky-Amute Watershed Council. I'm looking forward to this conversation about watershed health. So welcome to Conservation Spotlight, everyone.
Hi there. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
Thanks. Well, happy spring. It is a gorgeous sunny day and the Willamette Valley is getting ready to burst. And I imagine many people out there are enjoying the natural beauty of this area that we are lucky enough to call home. But if you're like me, you walk around the parks and the waterways and see challenges, but also opportunities. So I'd like to dive in and see the watershed through your lens and find out how listeners can support the council's mission. So let's start by giving our listeners a bit of context and think big picture. And I'll start with you, Jordan. Jordan Perez, who is the executive director for the LWC. Can you explain the area of the Lucky-Amute watershed?
Yeah, no problem. So we are a drainage of the Coast Range's eastern flank. The waters flow east from the Coast Range divide down towards their confluence with the Willamette River. In the beginning of the organization, around the early 2000s, we focused primarily on the waters that enter the Lucky-Amute River drainage. But as a council, we have since adopted the Ash Creek watershed into our management area as well. And this inclusion, it really extends us further north into Polk County up to the Dallas area. And because rivers and streams don't follow human boundaries, our work is in both Polk and Benton counties. For anyone that's looking on a map, the town of Dallas would be a landmark for our northern boundary. And then the hills west of Falls City and the Black Rock mountain bike trail system up that way, that really marks our upper northwestern corner. And then if you were to follow the eastern slope of the Coast Range down, heading towards Beazell Memorial Forest Park in the Kings Valley region, that's where you'll pick up our southwestern boundary. And then staying just north of Corvallis and heading east along the kind of northern face of the McDonald Dunn Forest, the watershed captures waters flowing along the E.E. Wilson Wildlife Area and making our way out to our eastern boundaries of the Willamette River at the Lucky-Amute State Natural Area. Included in that is right here at our office in Independence. So we, with the Ash Creek, we pick up Independence and Monmouth City as well.
Yeah, all of my favorite natural places to visit in this area are included in the watershed. And I love that it also includes the urban as well as rural areas. Jordan, I'm wondering if you can share with our listeners about the goals and the mission of the Lucky-Amute Watershed Council, which is a nonprofit, right?
Yeah. So our official mission is to engage, assist landowners and communities in the voluntary protection, restoration, and enhancement of the Lucky-Amute and Ash Creek watersheds. A major focus is on the voluntary part. We are, like you said, a nonprofit organization, and that is our core. We are at our core made up of a board of directors that is entirely voluntary participation. And we want landowners and communities to be empowered to take the initiative with stewardship and be excited about the possibilities that come with restoration projects and general awareness of watershed health. A watershed impacts every person that lives within the drainage and economic means, recreation, lifestyle, safety, and in our ability to understand and appreciate the natural world. As an organization, we can then lend support in the way of funding, planning, and ongoing maintenance. So the Watershed Council does the homework for the community by holding committees with experts, identifying recommendations for priority areas, locating restoration businesses and contractors, and considering the changing social relations of the area.
Thank you.
And I inherited a really great team here that has fantastic projects and history with the organization. So they've been fantastic to learn from along the way.
And in getting ready for our conversation today, I was reading up on the history of the watershed on your website, which is fascinating, by the way. And I was wondering if you could speak to how the watershed was managed historically and how that affects the LWC's restoration work today.
Yeah, absolutely. This area is such a fantastically beautiful region of Oregon. It's easy to see why humans have been drawn to the region for a long, long time. The Lucky Mutant Ash Creek watersheds have been managed by peoples of the region in different ways based on their cultural understanding of the environment and natural processes. For as long as people have been on this landscape, though, there has been some form of management, one sort or another. Before Euro pioneers came to the area, native cultures such as the Kalapuya would have managed the landscape in a way of more directing or enhancing the naturally occurring processes and mimicking them in a timeline that was beneficial to the people, but maintained a sustainability so that the native plants and wildlife could be counted on for future generations. The lands of the watershed would have been visited more on a seasonal round following the harvest of different plants and animals like salmon, wapato, camas, acorns, and the natural cycles of nature like fire and floods would have been appreciated for their benefits to the land. Again, learning from nature and appreciating the positive effects that fire has by burning back dead grasses and shrubs, allowing for low-growing harvestable plants would then thrive, and oaks would grow faster, larger, more plentiful with acorns. Flooding would have been seen as a positive for bringing in wetland vegetation like wapato and bringing nutrients from the mountains to the soils of the floodplain. And I envision this as more of directing the flow rather than totally altering it. But then, as Euro-American pioneers and missionaries came to the region, they had an entirely different view of land use. And the land management practices were more of an industrialization of the landscape and natural resources. And at this time, there was not a formal science of environmental processes and ecology. So the information or knowledge that pioneers of the time had was geared towards recreating the land uses practices of Europe and Eastern America rather than studying and adapting to the landscape and cultural knowledge of this place. And so more of a cut and paste approach. And so they did not have the insight as to what the long-term effects might occur to the based off of the landscape being altered. And the lower wetlands would have been drained and converted to agricultural lands for growing non-native crops. Streams were straightened and shortened on their path to the Willamette River so that agricultural goods and timber could be transported more quickly. And around the 1850s, a timber industry began in the Hoskins area of the watershed, and streams were primarily seen as a transport route for logs to get them to the sawmill downstream and out of the region. So the practice of splash damming and creation of straightened channels moved massive logs in an expedited pace, and this just scoured the stream bed of all the beneficial gravels and diverse habitat regions. We still have long-lasting effects of these practices, and those are a lot of what we are working to restore at this very time. Luckily, along the way, the landowner's mindset has changed, and there is far more consideration for the habitats and natural processes.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that historic land management is so important to know. And I know there's a lot more information about this, Suzanne, on your website. Can you direct folks to find out more about these topics?
Yeah, sure. We host regular Sips and Science pub talks at different venues around the watershed, and we record those. And a lot of people that have insight and knowledge of the history of this area have been a part of these Sips and Science talks. And the recordings of those talks are available on our website, www.luckymutelwc.org, or you can go to our YouTube channel, just search for Lucky Mute Watershed Council, and you can get a list of the different talks that are available.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate that big picture view of the watershed, Jordan. But let's shift gears now and talk about how you put all these ideas and passions into projects. And Aubrey Cloud, you're the restoration project director and the boots on the ground person for the LWC. Can you share with our listeners what the concerns are? That the council is focused on currently.
So the watershed councils in general are really kind of primarily focused on fish restoration, the recovery of fish populations, more specifically salmonids. Like in the Willamette Valley, we have a couple listed species, the spring Chinook run and the winter steelhead. And a lot of the restoration work that we do is focused on improving access to and the quality of the spawning habitat for these fish so that their populations can kind of start to rebound and recover. In recent years, there's also been an increasing focus on some culturally important fish species, such as our two lamprey species, especially Pacific lamprey. But luckily, if it's good salmon habitat, it's probably good lamprey habitat too. So the two often go hand in hand. So a lot of our work is focused kind of in the headwaters of the watershed. There was a series of assessments that were done in the kind of late 2000s, early 2010s. And those kind of helped us identify both the best existing fish habitat and the best potential fish habitat. And again, that focus is spawning, but there's also a sec another focus, and that's summer cold water refuge. Our native salmonids, kind of the biggest water quality challenge they face is water temperature. They're cold water adapted fish species. So once the temperatures in the summer start to creep over 18 degrees Celsius, it becomes really challenging for these native species to hang on. And so what they need are little cold water refuge systems that they can get into to escape those elevated temperatures and kind of make it through that challenging season. And that often is also in the headwaters where the water's just kind of seeping out of the ground and it's still really cold and shaded and it hasn't kind of had a lot of time going through the bottomlands and warming up. So the kind of projects we do are usually addressing any passage barriers that inhibit the fish's ability to access that habitat. And the classic example is a dam. But it can also be, and actually is more often in our watershed, undersized culverts or perched culverts. By perched, we mean the culvert is sitting above the bed of the creek or waterway, and the fish have to make a jump to pass through that culvert. And if it's too high, then fish, especially the juveniles, can't make that jump. So things like that we want to address. And then we're also trying to restore some foundational systemic processes that were interrupted by some of those historical land management practices that Jordan talked about. The logging and the splash damming kind of starved our waterways of large woody debris, which plays a really critical role in structuring the habitat and maintaining it for the fish that we're focused on. The logs slow down the water flow and allow gravels and other sediments being carried by winter flows to slow down and sort out and aggrade on the bottom of the channel instead of flushing out of the system. And those gravels are super important because that's what the fish spawn in, and it also allows water to go under it and cool in the summer. Whereas if it's just bedrock, exposed bedrock, there's nowhere for the water to go, and you're going to get increased warming. It also pushes the water out onto the floodplain, which is really important because, for example, juvenile fish have a hard time kind of surviving if they're in the full force of a heavy flood, and they have to get off into these slower water, slack water refuges on the wings of the system where they can rest, conserve energy, and avoid predators and find food for themselves so they can grow. So a lot of our work is focused on restoring and enhancing that habitat in the parts of the watershed where we know it either exists or has potential to exist. And then we also focus on parts of the watershed that would be really valuable at other life stages for the fish. So a good example is the Lucamute State Natural Area, or LSNA. And that's a big state park right at the confluence of the Lucamute River with the Willamette. It also happens to be right across from the Santiam's confluence. This park is almost 1,000 acres of conserved land. And when you add in land adjacent and connected to it, that's owned by other agencies or land trusts or neighbors who are doing active conservation on their private property, it's over 1,000 acres of really important floodplain habitat right on the Willamette. It's actually really noteworthy because it's the largest remnant floodplain forest along the Willamette River in the whole of the valley. And with all the restoration work that we've done and are continuing to do there, that record is only growing. We have planted almost 300 acres, and in those acres, we've installed over 800,000 plants, with more in development and coming down the pipe. And the landscape there is really important because the spring Chinook that I mentioned earlier, they need this kind of floodplain habitat to, again, like I mentioned earlier, get out on the floodplain during high flows and escape those high velocities, hunt for food, avoid predators, just rest, that kind of thing. And there's that kind of floodplain habitat on the mainstem Willamette is pretty rare these days, and this is a really important kind of anchor habitat as we conceive and talk about them. We've even done a floodplain reconnection project there where we have notched some of the banks to make it easier for the more regular flooding events to engage and activate the floodplain there. This is a state park, so it's open to the public, and there's some really lovely trails that go through, and you can see a ton of our plantings there at various stages of maturity and establishment. You can see new forest coming up against the backdrop of gallery forest. It's enhancing, just a lot of really cool stuff to see. And then there's other programs like our invasive species management. We have to be really strategic about what species we choose to throw limited resources at. Our big one is knotweed, also along the rivers, and that is again linked to fish because it really degrades these riparian and floodplain habitats that are so important to the fish that we're trying to restore. But yeah.
That's great. And I appreciate the shout out to LSNA or Nakumute State Natural Area. That's one of my favorite places to go. And actually, I think that was where I first really connected with the Lucky Mute Watershed Council. You had a volunteer day where folks were out there mulching these plantings, and I just wanted to go and meet everyone and get involved. And so I always enjoy going back and seeing the plants growing and thriving. It's such a beautiful place to visit. So thank you so much, Aubrey. Just a quick update. If you're just joining us, I'm here with the folks with the Lucky Mute Watershed Council, and we've been talking about their mission and projects that support a healthy watershed. And you're listening to Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming on KMUZ.org. Okay. Another important role at the LWC is outreach, which is led by Suzanne. Suzanne, you've been such a great mentor and support for me since I started doing outreach with Polk SWCD. And I see you as the community builder for the watershed, which I think is really important because protecting our natural resources and environment is not just a task for professionals. It really takes the whole community to make an impact. Can you share with our listeners what are some ways that the council is engaged with the community and other partners?
Yeah, absolutely, Morgan. In addition to all the restoration work that Aubrey just talked about, a key part of our mission is to strengthen the connection between people and their watershed. So when people feel connected to the land and the rivers around them, they're inspired to care for them. The focus of our community outreach and volunteer events, which are all part of our Love Your Watershed program, is to give people both the knowledge and the tools they need to protect watershed health at home and in their communities. And all of this would not be possible without the support and expertise of our many, many partners, including Polk Soil and Water Conservation District and Benton SWCD as well, Ash Creek Water Control District, other nonprofits, tribal partners, and all of our federal, state, and local agency partners as well. One of the great collaborations I want to highlight is the Mid-Willamette Beaver Partnership. We're working with the Marys River, the Calpulla, North Santiam, and South Santiam Watershed Councils, Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and two local tribal natural resource departments, Grand Ronde and Siletz, to promote coexistence with beavers on the landscape. Beavers are incredible ecosystem engineers, and their presence can help make our lands more resilient to drought and wildfire. So the MWBP just launched a brand new website at mwbbeaverpartnership.org that serves as a kind of a one-stop shop for landowners and land managers looking for solutions to beaver-related challenges, or for those who just want to learn more about how to support beaver habitat on their own properties. And last but not least, I have to give a special shout out to all of our board members and volunteers. They all donate countless hours to conducting meetings, helping out at events, envelope stuffing at the office, helping Jonah with our monitoring coordinator with putting out temperature monitor loggers in our waterways, and doing such a great job sharing their skills to make our work even more effective.
What are some things that people can do at home to help protect our watershed, Suzanne?
So I think that one of the best things people can do at home is to get to know the plants and animals living in their yard and learn how to enhance their own little piece of the local landscape. One of my favorite books is Doug Tallamy's Nature's Best Hope, And in it, he points out how when you add up all those suburban yards, they cover more land than our national parks. So that makes backyard conservation a game changer for biodiversity. We can do so much good by planting more of our native species and by removing invasive ones that don't support our pollinators and wildlife nearly as well. And it doesn't matter if you have lots of acres or just a balcony, any amount of native plants providing food and shelter can make a real difference. By turning yards, gardens, and even container plantings into stepping stones for wildlife, we can create corridors through all of those built environments we live in that allow birds and butterflies, bees, and other beneficial insects to thrive. Plus, native plants are adapted to our climate, so they don't need watering once they're established. So you'll not only be helping your watershed, you'll be cutting your water bill. And also, so I want to say that backyard conservation just happens to be the focus of our Love Your Watershed program for 2025 and 2026. So many of our upcoming events will highlight things you can do to improve watershed health right at home. Or you can also find a lot of resources on our website about how to select and grow native plants, how to conserve water and protect biodiversity in your yard.
Thank you. Nature's Best Hope. That's one of my favorite books, too. So I highly recommend that to our listeners. That has been such an inspiration to me in my role. Suzanne, what do you got cooking? What are some events that you have coming up? And what's the best way to stay in touch with all things LWC?
That's a great question, Morgan. We've got so many great events coming up, starting with a volunteer ivy pull this Saturday along Ash Creek in Independence, and that'll be in honor of Earth Day. Then we have two bird walks coming up in May, one of which will be entirely in Spanish. But anyone is welcome, whether you're a Spanish speaker or Spanish learner, you're welcome to join. We're also excited about our June 28 wetland dedication by the Sports Park in Independence, where we'll be unveiling two brand new interpretive panels that celebrate the importance of wetlands and also honor Michael Cairns, who just passed away last year and was a founding member of our council and a huge wetland protection advocate. And then later this summer, we'll be hosting a dragonfly walk, a paddle at LSNA, and then in the fall, we'll be kicking off our Sips and Science Pub Talk series that I mentioned. The best way to stay updated is to visit our website at luckymutelwc.org and sign up for an email list. You can also subscribe to our quarterly Meanderings newsletter, which features our seasonal updates, restoration project news, and all of our upcoming events. And of course, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to our YouTube channel. For anyone listening who'd like to get even more engaged, I really encourage you to join our Friends of the LWC Network. A $25 donation or volunteering at just one event per year gets you access to our monthly behind-the-scenes bulletins, and you get early event notifications, which is really great because a lot of our limited capacity events fill up super fast.
Suzanne, thank you so much. And thank you, Jordan and Aubrey. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having us, and thank you for helping to shine a spotlight on the Lucky Mute Watershed Council.
Absolutely. I've been talking with the folks with the Lucky Mute Watershed Council about the important work they do. I hope you leave this conversation today with a deeper appreciation for all of the work that goes into keeping our watersheds healthy. I'm your host, Morgan Neal, Outreach Coordinator for the Polk Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Conservation Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed our conversation today. Every effort matters, and together we can make a difference in conserving our natural resources. Please be sure to visit the LWC's website, luckymutelwc.org, and our website, polkswcd.com, or our Facebook page for resources on how you can contribute to local conservation efforts. Also, sharing this podcast with others is a great way to spread awareness and encourage positive action. Coming up, we have an emerald ash borer workshop at the Dallas Aquatic Center on April 26th, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. We also have a pollinator hedgerow tour at Hopfield Willamette Farm on May 22nd. And if you liked what you heard here on Conservation Spotlight, tune in next month to KMUZ at 88.5 or 100.7 FM, the third Wednesday every month during Willamette Wake Up. Thanks for listening and keep up the conservation conversation.